Hey everyone, this is Connor. Before we get started, I just want to encourage you to check out our Patreon, patreon.com/podsidepicnic. If you become a patron, you'll get access to multiple exclusive episodes every month. And you can also join our patrons-only Discord chat, where Pete and I talk informally with the Podside Picnic community. So if you like the show, go ahead and check us out at patreon.com/podsidepicnic. Thanks.
Welcome back to Podside, everyone. This is, of course, Carlo. And today, it's just me and old Pete. Pete, what you doing, man?
Oh, being old, apparently. Thank you very much.
Sorry, I'm also old.
Yeah, we are of an age.
We are of the same age, pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, past a certain point, everybody's the same age.
Well, you stop. Yeah, it doesn't become an issue after a certain point. Yeah,
exactly. It's just like how wrinkly you are. That's the only question. Chewy is also very committed to this episode. Thank you, Chewy.
Oh my goodness, he's got wow.
Yeah,
Chewy, so, you sure you want me to cut that, Chewy? That's a little inflammatory, Chewy.
So the thing is, our neighbor is getting DoorDash right now, and Chewy always thinks this is an opportunity to commit murder, and I respect it. Yeah, buddy.
Consistency, you know?
Yeah. See, if you keep this up, I'm going to another room, buddy, and you won't be able to bark at me. Sit. Okay, so sorry. That's my household. How's yours?
I'm doing okay. So what I was going to say is that, yeah, after a certain point, unless you're a mile plus long dragon, right?
Yes.
So today we're going to talk about the man who painted the Dragon Grial. I think that's how I pronounce it. But anyway.
I'm glad you said it first because I had no idea.
I just imagined it being like spoken in a snooty, almost French. The man who painted the Dragon Grial. by Lucius Shepard, who I had never read before this one story. And this story really sort of like I sat there and I was like, got to the end of it. And I was like, what did I just read?
Well, I'm glad that was your reaction because while I certainly enjoyed it, it was in some ways it reminded me of the story with the bears with fire.
Mm. I mean, it does have that sort of like I feel like it's overused now. I hate using it, but it does seem to have like a much more sort of literary, introspective bent to it.
Yeah, like this story is not about the plot because I mean the plot is frankly tedious. Mm-hmm. It's the story, you know, it's the thing itself that's supposed to be interesting. And I honestly did like it. I do have a history with this author. Like, we haven't hung out or anything, but like
he never opened a restraining order against you.
Exactly. Well, there's definitely a story of his which did connect with me deeply, and we will cover that when the time comes, I suppose.
Yeah. I honestly, this is the first thing of his I read, and I've liked it enough. Like, don't get me wrong. I will say that, like I said, you know, what did I just read? But I meant that, you know, complimentary because it's sort of left me like it feels. I think you were like starting to get into it, right? Because it feels like a fresh idea that suddenly becomes like, oh, okay, I think I see where this is going. And then it just sort of like veers off in this odd direction and ends on a note which just sort of like, I don't even know how to describe it exactly. Mm-hmm. Like a rumination more than anything else.
Yeah.
Or the closing of a circle or something. You know, it just felt very odd and weird and sort of like, numinous, I suppose, would be a word that I could use here.
Well, I mean, I certainly couldn't call you out on it because does that mean giving off light? I'm not sure.
No, not luminous, numinous. Like from, yeah, Numenor. People from Numenor, they're numinous.
Ah, now, okay.
Having strong religious or spiritual quality.
Oh, okay. I am growing as a person today. Thank you.
There you go. Growing and learning. So, you know, but yeah, you know, Pete, you could be the man who didn't do anything else but sit your ass down and listen to the Dragon Grial today. So, no, it's all good, man. I wanted to sort of like give an idea of, because it's sort of the structure feels, it at once feels familiar, but also it feels perfectly like the exact right thing to do here, which is it opens each section of like a portion of this artist's life. Cause it's about this artist called, Merrick Kattanay. Mm-hmm. And, essentially it opens with like some sort of, I guess like a found document, something about his, like documenting his life, his work, and so on and so forth. And then it then moves into like a specific era of that artist's life, right?
Yeah. Oh, and I'd also like to call out here, like the first, I don't know what you call it, couple of pages feel like a fable.
Yes, absolutely. You know what? You sort of tipped me to I was wondering if I should just read like the opening, and you just tipped me in favor of doing so, because it really does feel like you said, but sort of like a weird it's like a fairy tale, but like for adults who want to hear a fairy tale.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so it says, in 1853, in a country far to the south, in a world separated from this one by the thinnest margin of possibility, a dragon named Grial dominated the region of the Carbonatus Valley, a fertile area centered upon the town of Teocinte and renowned for its production of silver, mahogany, and indigo. There were other dragons in those days, most dwelling on rocky islands west of Patagonia, also in Pete's house. Tiny, irascible creatures, the largest of them no bigger than a swallow. But Grial was one of the great beasts who had ruled an age. Over centuries, he had grown to stand 750 feet high at the mid-back, and from the tip of his tail to his nose, he was 6,000 feet long. It should be noted here that the growth of dragons was due not to caloric intake, but to the absorption of energy derived from the passage of time. Had it not been for a miscast spell, Grial would have died millennia before. The wizard entrusted with the task of slaying him, knowing his own life would be forfeited as a result of the magical backwash, had experienced a last-second twinge of fear, and diminished by his ounce of courage, the spell had flown a mortal inch awry. Though the wizard's whereabouts were unknown, Grial remained alive. His heart had stopped, his breath stilled, but his mind continued to seethe, to send forth the gloomy vibrations that enslaved all who stayed for long within range of his influence.
Grim.
And so, yeah, no, I love it because it sort of sets this tone where Grial is not even like it's not even quite like an antagonist. He's just sort of like seeped into the landscape at this point, right?
Right.
Like it's a toxic waste. Like it's a Superfund site.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's no longer an antagonist.
Not directly, and in no way that anyone could possibly like put their, you know, push against with their flesh and blood hands, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. I'm trying to cuddle up to Chewie because that is the last resort to shut him up.
I see. Yes. Well, you know, if you need to give him a hug,
yes, feel free. He's trying to paw at the laptop. It's like, I too have a huge annoying dragon I would like to poison over 50 years.
So yeah, so let's get into it because you just jumped into it.
The plan.
No, it's perfect. So the funny thing about this is that initially I wasn't sure if this was like from the title, right? Mm-hmm. It could go one of two ways, right? It's either a portraiture or what ends up happening, which I didn't even really think about until it started positing this option, right? It's like, mm-hmm. You mean like paint him? Oh, okay.
Yeah. That caught me off guard too. Like you're literally painting the dragon.
It sounds like a weird metaphor for some fantasy drug, right?
Yeah, it does. Painting the dragon, or it's like they should hold like a little ran fair in front of him or something, and like you know paint,
just paint everyone's face, you know. Oh, dragon fair, we love it. or at the very least, the residents of that valley, because of the gloomy shadow that hangs over them, basically would would never say they love it or yay. They merely sort of like go like I tolerate this.
Yes.
So Merrick Ketane goes before the city councilman, right? And to sort of like we were just talking about, decides, you know, like I'm gonna paint the dragon. And the rationale here is that the toxins from the paints will eventually seep into, you know, through the scales and into the, you know, Grell's body and slowly poison, you know, and kill off his mind, right? That's the idea. And, you know, like basically the plan is a 40 to 50 year plan is the initial sort of estimate that Ketane gives them. Mm-hmm. I did love how the city fathers are described. So it says here, the city fathers voiced their incredulity and Merrick waited impatiently until they quieted. They did not enjoy dealing with these worthies. He did not enjoy dealing with these worthies. Seated at their long table, sour-faced, a huge smudge of soot on the wall above their heads, like an ugly thought they were sharing. They reminded him of the Wine Merchant Association in Regensburg, the time they had rejected his group portrait. I just love that little description of like the soot. a bad thought they were sharing. It's such a great little detail.
It's awesome. Watching his transition, like I'm used to his novels and I know most of his work was short stories and nonfiction, but it's wild to me seeing him be more careful with his prose. That sounded like it's a hack. I didn't mean it that way.
Mm-hmm. No. I mean, I think there is something to the short fiction. You do have to really make every word count. Otherwise, you know, it gets a little bloated. You can be a little freer, at longer lengths, you know, you don't have, or rather you are encouraged to be as concise as you can, but you got lots more room, right?
Yep.
So, I really sort of love those little flourishes, right? It's just like this little treat dropped right in the middle of a paragraph. So eventually he decides to go up to basically, he's going to wait until they decide. He's asked them for, 500 ounces of silver to get the project going?
Yeah.
And he has like an entire plan set up, which is, you know, I found this to be really interesting in a certain way because it's not like meticulously detailed, but there's enough detail to show you that, you know, Shepard probably did some research into what a large, you know, art, you know, painting project would entail, right? And, you know, what would be necessary with the technology that he's working with, which seems to be more or less like it's mid-1800s, so yeah.
Right.
Mid-19th century. And like the idea of placing all the, like the mixtures and the calciners and different, I forget exactly all the tech, right? That he wants to place it like on the dragon's head, which mm-hmm. makes it, in my mind, just makes this really incongruous, somewhat funny image, right? They're just using this dragon's head as like a big shop floor, basically.
yeah, it's pretty wild. You know, I'm doing the thing we always joke about. It's awesome, man.
I liked it. It was cool. Okay, but bye, everyone. Thanks.
Hope you enjoyed listening.
Like and subscribe. But anyway, yeah, I think that it's sort of interesting to try to analyze something that I believe both of us really enjoyed. I think it's a difficulty to explain exactly why you liked something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, especially something that didn't meet your expectations. I mean, like this was definitely, I walked in this and I honestly expected a fucking dragon, and that's not what I got. I got a statue that was dying.
But see, I mean, think of it this way, Pete. The dragon real in this, for all intents and purposes, and we can get into like the more, you know, sort of like spiritual or whatever aspects that this story contains, right? Mm-hmm. But also just the plain fact that this is essentially the sci-fi premise of a big dumb object, except it's in fantasy.
Yeah. I mean, our dragon is a MacGuffin. I mean, his purpose is to build a story around him.
Well, I mean, he is a bit of an influencer in that area.
Hey-o. Well, that's true. Like he does do the eye thing.
Yeah, well, that was something that I really enjoyed. Let me see if I can find this. Hold on. Because there's also like a beautiful description, right? Because he gets sent while he's waiting for the city fathers to decide. We've sort of spoiled that already. They decide to give him the project. Yeah. But
it would be a pretty stupid story if they didn't.
Well, it's very short. more on the et side of the novelette, if you will, if you know what I mean.
Instead, they gave everyone a tax cut and the dragon remained.
Look, well, you know, if you could start an art business and keep it open for exactly 18 months, you could get a 30% tax credit.
Yes. And you know, under the right conditions, we'll allow you to, we'll give you an interest-free loan to pay your employees, but...
Yes, exactly. So anyway, there's a great little description that sort of drives home the point that we're talking about, right? Like Griel is the dragon, but he's also like literally part of the landscape. Like yes. he's more than a mile long, right? So the description is, you know, the scales were hexagonals, 30 feet across and half that distance high. Their basic color was a pale greenish gold, but some were whitish, draped with peels of dead skin, and others were overgrown by viridian moss. And the rest were scrolled with patterns of lichen and algae that resembled the characters of a serpentine alphabet. Birds had nested in the cracks, and ferns plumed from the interstices, thousands of them lifting in the breeze. It was a great hanging garden whose scope took Merrick's breath away, like looking around the curve of a fossil moon. The sense of all the centuries accreted in the scales made him dizzy, and he found he could not turn his head, but could only stare at the panorama, his soul shriveling with a comprehension of the timelessness and bulk of this creature to which he clung to like a fly.
Yeah, that was moving. Now talk about his butthole.
Well, it's full of skizzers. So little bald-headed freaks.
It's like that was definitely. I mean, I was like, wow, this is really evocative. And then there was a paragraph discussion of the creatures living in a dying dragon's butthole, and I'm like. 100% wasn't expecting this.
But I think that's something that this does over and over, right? In you know, different ways throughout the narrative, it seems to ground you know, whenever there's something that is sort of, you know, numinous or sublime or what have you, right? Not too far after that, that same thing is sort of taken down a notch, and it's sort of shown you how it exists in a space, right? In the place that it is.
Yep.
And I feel like that's a really interesting thing, because at the end of it, I mean, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but at the end of it, part of what, you know, Merrick is contemplating when he looks back over his life is, you know, essentially how much did he have to take to make the art that he ended up making?
Hmm.
You know, like this idea that, sure, the Dragon Grial has been painted. It looks lovely. Like it, you know, I think that one of the descriptions is that, you know, as the setting sun, the setting sun's rays, you know, move across the landscape, the paintings sort of are almost imbued with an inner light. It's like they capture the light or something like that. But the surrounding hills have been browned because, you know, they've cut down all the trees to make fires and to run all the calciners and all the fucking stuff that you need to do to run the, essentially the art project that you're doing, right?
Right, right. And the other thing about this, and I love it how they just sort of, like, they worm it in fairly towards the front, and they're like, yeah, we're not dealing with this anymore, is it's very clear that this artist is not attempting to kill the dragon.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's sort of driven, it's sort of like that question is answered, you know, in full by the very, very end. But you know, I do love that the assistant that is taking him up to see this dragon is not particularly sort of impressed with him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, she's like, you're a clever fellow. And, you know, Merrick sort of like, I guess maybe puffs out his chest a little bit. She's like, don't mean nothing by it. Being clever ain't nothing, ain't an accomplishment. It's just something you come by, like being tall.
Yes.
It's beautiful.
And it's like, very true.
Yes. Yes. I mean, you have a tendency to, you know, crawl up and disappear up your own ass, perhaps with or without skizzers in it.
There, yeah, I'm going to worry about that tonight, frankly.
Just, you know, scrub it out. Scrub it out, Pete.
Skizzer check! Yeah.
But yeah. So, you know, basically then we jump ahead to, I believe, a moment where the project is well underway. You know, like like you said, Pete, like at the end of this sequence, after he comes back, you know, like it's a week later, in fact, that the city fathers ask for him. They approve the project. You know, he gets the, you know, 500 ounces of silver. And then he's like, ha ha, you're going to have to ask for somebody else to come here or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was like really thrown by that, because then the next part is like, well, the project is well underway. And you're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
How does that connect?
Yeah, no, that's...
Weren't you just going to leave these people high and dry?
Yeah, I mean, like honestly, if somebody handed me that much gold, my next step would be flight. But I'm not an obsessive artist.
Mm. Well, also, I think that the issue is that you're supposed to leave that section with that question, which then slowly, you know, starts to really prey on Merrick's own thoughts. Why did he do this? You know, why did he agree to this? He keeps on sort of like going back to the, that central question, you know, because it does seem to be that he wasn't really, like you said, he had no intention of solving their dragon problem specifically, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That wasn't his goal at all. I mean, it's just mere coincidence. It died, you know, in a timely manner enough to you know, mm-hmm. to fit.
Well, I mean, so let me ask you, because I'm not an expert, but I do think that there might be some truth to, like, the poisons could seep in. Now, granted, I don't know, you know, how much you'd need over 50 or 40 years or whatever, but, I don't know if he, like you said, it's one of these things where you're like, I guess maybe. Maybe, or it was just plain fucking luck. Who knows?
So it's like that dragon and that model in a Bond movie that was painted all over and died.
Oh, the Goldfinger. Yeah.
Yes. Why do we all know that story?
I think it was passed around often. I'm of a mind that it's almost like an urban legend at this point. I don't know if it's true or not.
Well, that is exactly it. I have no idea whether it actually happened. And I mean, and I think that circles right back to the story. You know, we're not supposed to know. In fact, I have a certain suspicion that the James Bond thing might have occurred to him.
Maybe. Because that is sort of like the same reasoning, right? Her skin couldn't breathe, man. Yes.
The dragon's skin couldn't breathe.
Yes, there you go. But yeah, I do love that unanswered question, right? Because even at the end, like Merrick is just like almost haunted by it. He doesn't really understand, you know, his own motivations for doing things. Mm-hmm. But before that, in part, that haunting happens in part because he starts basically having an affair with like one of his foreman's wives.
Yeah, like his third affair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like he'd had a couple here and there, but nothing that really stuck. And this was the one that really sort of like he continues to hold a candle for Lise. You know, for the rest of his life after this, which, you know, I guess if you're a romantic artist, romantic era, even an alternate Earth, romantic era poet, this is the type of thing that you just have immense yearning for the same person for the rest of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. I do that shit.
I mean, yeah, it feels, yeah, it sort of feels very funny, you know, sort of like to a more pragmatically minded person. But yeah, like it's also, yeah, that's part of like, you know, capital R romance is, you know, back in the day was just, you know, never being able to really, you know, be together. You know, you just had that yearning, that longing for each other.
Yeah, it's that unfinished business. It's what you think about.
It's generally just sort of an artistic way of saying, you know, high-minded horniness, you know.
Indeed. And I value both, really.
It's all good, yeah. So he has this affair, and it becomes clear later that that they've been found out, right?
Yes.
So the husband shows up like they're hiding out under where the wings sort of like have crumpled. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to exactly imagine because like it's hard to imagine something that's like a mile plus long, right?
Yep.
So the actual like size of Grail's wings sort of like crumpled to the ground essentially creates a series of caves under it that also apparently people have like weird superstitions about that. Oh, you don't go in those under that particular part of the dragon or anything. You stay away.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it didn't go well for them.
No, it did not. And in fact, I love they find like what seems to be like the calcified or perhaps petrified remains of some old dude. I love that the description says a spray of dust where his genitals would have been, you know, just a skeletal dude, like almost holding a ring that has an S on it. And that's it. Like there's an idea that this might have been the wizard that that you know tried to kill Grial, but and that he is somewhat also in the same state, right? Like this idea that he may not be dead.
Right.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Pete. I think you were going to say something, and I cut you off and continued.
No. You went to a good place. We're fine. I'm just
Is Chewy hogging things?
Yeah. Well, I went to the bedroom on the theory that he doesn't like going in here before bedtime because, like, what if I'm trying to sleep early? But no, he came right in. He's like, okay, let's go party, man. So he's been chewing on my shoe that I'm wearing as we've been talking.
The man who would appease the dragon Chewie. I lost a foot in the war, man. All right.
Yeah. Oh, so. Yeah, go ahead. You were discussing the affair and consequence.
Right. And so the husband goes after them. They sort of like duck and weave into like the weird folds of the wings that are sort of like they think that it's going to be dark, but the underside of those wings are like full of weird bioluminescent fungi and lichen and shit like that. And so it turns out that dude catches Merrick and starts like just wailing on him. Hooks, like he has like a weird hook as a weapon. Mm-hmm. Manages to hook him in the leg and just starts like just driving his skull into the ground. And it isn't until Jarka, who is the assistant who had taken him up on the dragon that first time around, shows up and just basically plants the hook in his back and, quote, takes care of business afterwards.
Yes.
And I guess the only thing I'm imagining is obviously she hid the body further down under the wing. So given that no one's going to go down there because of, superstitions and, bad feelings and bad vibes.
Yeah, I mean they didn't find the wizard. They're not going to find him.
Right, that's true. Or maybe they did, and they never talk about it. Who knows?
Yeah, anyway, it's not like there was a plaque up,
in memory of Sartorius V, with wizard extraordinaire,
failure at dragon slaying.
X extraordinaire. anyway, I do love that in the next sort of like interstitial, right, little excerpt from a book or whatever, it seems to be like a memoir of Lise, the woman who he was basically having the affair with. And more or less like we were talking about, she moves away. It's been decades. Like at that point, like she even thinks to herself that she might go back, but then goes, that's been too long. Never mind. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to be gained here. And I do love that she gets a letter out of the blue from Merrick. And part of it is that she reproduces part of it as such. My old friend for Regensburg, Louis Dardano, has been living here for the past few years, engaged in writing my biography. The narrative has a breezy feel, like a tale being told in a tavern, which, if you recall me telling you how this all began, is quite appropriate. But on reading it, I'm amazed my life has such a simple shape. One task, one passion. God, Lise, 70 years old, and I still dream of you. And I still think of what happened that morning under the wing. Strange that it has taken me all this time to realize it was not Jark, not you or I who was culpable, but Grielle. How obvious it seems now. I was leaving, and he needed me to complete the expression on his side, his dream of flying, of escape, to grant him the death of his desire. I am certain you will think I have leaped to this assumption, but I remind you that it has been a leap of 40 years duration. I know Grielle, know his monstrous subtlety. I can see it at work in every action that has taken place in the valley since my arrival. I was a fool not to understand that his powers were at the heart of our sad conclusion. The army now runs everything here, as no doubt you're aware. It is rumored that they're planning a winter campaign against Regensburg. Can you believe it? Their fathers were ignorant, but this generation is brutally stupid, and so on. I do love that last part because it feels like perennial, right? Everyone, you know, the old folks go, "Our kids these days."
One thing I should say is Lucius is known for writing stories that are based in Central America, particularly El Salvador. He's got a lot of ties. So like when he starts talking about the behavior of governments and military, it's very easy to just like draw that little line.
True. Yes. I mean, in this, I understood that, but weirdly, it's an odd thing because Griel does not sound like anything that's derived from Spanish or anything like from the region. Again, no expert. Maybe I'm absolutely off base, but I
certainly don't know of anything.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird because like Teocinte, the town feels very much like a sort of like an indigenously, you know, root, you know, like an indigenous town name or something like that in, mm-hmm. you know, Central America. But Grial sounds French.
Right. So it's about colonialism.
Well, yes, there is that.
Yes. Sorry, just I saw the low hanging fruit and I was holding the baseball bat, so I swung.
Good of you to get a home run on that tee ball, Pete. Make the most out of the situation. But no, I mean, I don't think it's something that is like super like, you know, knock on the screen. Hey, buddy, you know what this story's really about? Because it's sort of like just simply, it's almost like Grial himself, right? It's just sort of like seeped into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing you can do about it because even at the end, right? Like the major who comes to sort of like ask him for essentially open his books and sort of like, I guess, justify every expense he's had recently. And, you know, like he notes that the epaulettes that he has on his uniform have little dragon, you know, motifs on them. And he's sort of like going like, huh. So this is how this has worked. You know, basically the dragon's influence has sort of like gotten into just like the general populace. And in fact, like the whole idea is that they're shutting down the project, not because it's really done, but because they need resources for the war that they want to wage over the winter.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. I love that. You never really know whether he's just nuts or the dragon is a puppet master and all of this is by design.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also, one of the things that really struck me about this, right? Let me just take a look here because also I wanted to point out, this is, I think I made reference to it, but I do have the quote here about like the give and take between the art, right?
Yeah.
As the major continued his accounting, Merrick's gaze wandered out the window. The shantytown surrounding Grial had swelled into a city, now sprawled across the hills. Most of the buildings were permanent, wood and stone, and the cant of the roofs, the smoke from the factories around the perimeter put him in mind of Regensburg. All the natural beauty of the land had been drained into the painting. Blackish-gray rain clouds were muscling up from the east, but the afternoon sun shone clear and shed a heavy gold radiance on Grial's side. It looked as if the sunlight were an extension of the gleaming resins, as if the thickness of the paint were becoming infinite. He let the major's voice recede to a buzz and followed the scatter and dazzle of the images, and then, with a start, he realized the major was sounding him out about stopping the work. So, like we were talking about, like Major just basically wants to end the project.
Mm-hmm.
And in sort of like, basically, he can't really do anything about it. So Merrick just storms off again to, I guess, do a walk around the scaffolding that's been erected around Grial for the project, right? To paint him.
Yep.
He gets back up to the eye that we'd referenced before, where he, his initial experience was that the eye opens sort of like involuntarily. Or who knows? I mean, it's tough to say, you know, like it feels like essentially Grell is like in a coma and like essentially, you know, his body is not really voluntarily doing anything, or maybe it is. Who knows?
I was about to start belting out a Smith song, by the way. Dragon in a coma.
That's a song.
Yeah, that girlfriend in a coma.
Oh, I see. Well,
I think it's serious.
Well, yeah.
Sorry.
Morrissey's a terrible person now. So
yes, yes, he is, and I am too for like dragging that into this.
That's all good, man. I mean, the Smiths were cool. I don't have to buy their albums anymore.
Indeed. Which anyway, is even cooler.
Yes. But yeah, I do love that he sort of like walks up to the eye, and that's sort of like he meets like a younger girl that reminds him of Lise. Mm-hmm. And apparently she goes up there often and, you know, like sees, looks into the eye, because the first time he goes up there with Jark, essentially the eye opens of its own accord. And like, I guess in the colors surrounding the iris, he starts to like get like a vision, like it's sort of psychedelic almost the way it's described. And then suddenly he's sort of like flying into the sun, and he sort of like realizes that this might be, you know, either like the last wishes, or, you know, exactly what, where Grial's mind is, right?
It's right.
Like ascending somehow, blah, 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 so on and so forth.
I must confess that when I first started reading about that, my thought was the Hypnotoad.
Well, I mean, it's not too far off the mark, right?
Because yeah.
He does sort of like become, I mean, at the end, right? Like we're debating this, right? Because it does seem like he's being sincere. Unless, mm-hmm. You know, like I don't. That's the thing. The tone throughout this is at a certain distance from even Merrick, who is the main character. It's almost as if the story itself is a historiography of Merrick. And it also has other historiographies of him in it.
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. It's almost like a shuffled deck of people's lives. You get pieces, like the core of it is the one guy, but you get pieces of a few other people, and it's not, I mean, it's not really a plot per se. I mean, you can describe this as narrative, but I don't really feel like it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's, I think it's supposed to be very, if I may, it's like light glinting off individual scales, and you have to sort of
nice.
And you have to sort of, like an impressionistic painting, or a pointillism painting as well. You sort of like have, it's your job to sort of compose all those dots and gleams and so on into a coherent story.
Yes.
And that's the thing. This, I do feel like the idea of the painting and the pigments sort of betraying a depth that they did not, you know, initially, this is what that story does, right?
Yeah.
Like at the end of it, really what it feels like is the ruminations of an artist, of perhaps even Shepherd himself, you know, sort of like working out how he feels about his writing or his art, you know, like this idea that you can be sort of narrowed down to this one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And are you just that simple? You know, I don't know. I'd like to think for myself, I'd like to think not.
Yeah. But I mean, I think if you wrote the narrative of my life, you would not be able to sell it at Bain Books. Yeah, you know what
I mean? I mean, sure. I mean, I'm not going for like, you know, I think that's the other thing, right? Like you know what I was thinking of? Speaking of, like, this pursuit of greatness made me think of, just briefly earlier, I was reminded of, like, this old Peanuts cartoon where Schroeder is talking to Lucy on his little, you know, his little piano, and he mentions to her that Beethoven was a great man. And Lucy's point of view is, what made him great? Was he a king? Did he conquer? I'm obviously paraphrasing some of it, but basically her idea was, like, he for someone to be great, they had to fill these particular, you know, things. And that generally means that you end up affecting other people's lives, sometimes not for the better.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really good point about what a story is. I mean, what you're talking about ties perfectly into it.
Yeah. I mean, and it's that, I think that's the thing that spoke to me and sort of left me a little, not exactly troubled, but just simply like, not just like, oh, that was a cool story.
Right. Yeah.
It was cool, man.
It was cool. I have something I want to say about Lucius, but not about the story, if I can.
Go for it. Yeah. I think we've gotten to the end of it. I just think I really, by the end of it, I was sort of like struck by sort of like what a profound and somewhat like almost beautiful sentiment that it seemed to be trying to get at.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of feel like he was trying to make an interesting structure rather than make a point. And I think he succeeded at that beautifully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed.
So Lucius, actually, there's a better way to talk about this, through personal narrative. My freshman year of college, when I went to the bookstore and bought all of my books, I had 10 bucks left over. And so I started looking around, and there were some fiction books, and there was exactly one science fiction book for sale at the college bookstore. And it was called Life During Wartime. And I got that book and I read it cover to cover again and again and again for years, to the point where the book got destroyed and I couldn't remember the motherfucker's name. And it was only until much later I got it back and started researching. But it's I believe that I wouldn't overstep and say that it's better than like The Forever War or Starship Troopers. But I think it's within throwing distance of those war novels. Like, it is that good. And it was only a second novel.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, just an extraordinary piece. And it's like where, you know, the Forever War is about the pointlessness of war, and Starship Troopers is about...
Isn't war cool?
Yeah, it's just, look what I can do. And then, but Life During Wartime is about the destructiveness and chaos of a bunch of guys fucking around. And I mean, if that's not a good description of war, I don't know what is.
Yeah. I mean, also, like you say, the second novel, and granted, this is not to dismiss that, because writing a novel, like writing anything in longer form than short stories, is really hard. It really is. And if you can manage it, like, that's an accomplishment in and of itself. I'm not going to lie. Whether it's good is another story, but finishing a book is a lot. So kudos to anyone who does that. But like, you know, like having said that, as I understand it, Lucius came to writing like later in life.
Very much so, in his 40s.
Yeah, like it seems to me that he has like a nice bit of like life experience under his belt. And like even in this story, like the tone itself really feels really different than something that I'd pick up today, right? In general, in genre. I don't want to sound like old man shouting at cloud here, but there is a tone in a lot of stories nowadays that feels very young.
Sure.
Not, you know, not like see, like, it doesn't feel like it's a voice that's seasoned yet. Which is fine. It is what it is. That's neither a good or bad thing. It's just simply like that seems to be the dominant thing. And this, because of that tone, really stood out to me too, right? Because it's something that feels, granted, it was printed in what, 1984 or whatever.
Sure.
What I was going to say is I had promised you that I'd save this for when we were on, you know, recording. And do you want to know what the ballot looked like in the 1984 Nebula Awards? Because it made it onto the ballot.
Let's hear it.
Okay. Trojan Horse by Michael Swanwick. Okay. This Story, The Lucky Strike by Kim Stanley Robinson.
we heard you. It's all right.
Yeah, it's all good. Everyone has typos of the mouth. It's fine. St. Teresa of the Aliens, which I don't think I've ever heard that one, by James Patrick Kelly. Bad Medicine by Jack Dan. Do you want to know who This Story was beaten by?
It's got to be Gibson.
No.
Okay, let's hear it.
Bloodchild, Octavia Butler, baby.
Oh my God.
And that, you know, that is one of those situations where you have to be like, well, you know, what can
if
I say?
Gonna
that
lose,
was the better
man.
Story.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, shit.
That's the better story. What can I say?
Yeah.
That's brutal. Because one of these days we should probably do Bloodchild, but this is not that. As Aragorn says, this is not that day.
Yeah. We're 50 minutes. We're not tacking that at the end, dude.
Anyway, but yeah, honestly, this is a novelette. It's weird because the first time I read it, it felt longer in part because I had to read it piecemeal. Like, I don't know what it was. It was just like I read a section and then I put it down and I'd read another section. And today was just like, I just breezed right through it. I mean, granted, it's a reread now, so I know where it's going.
Well, you know, if we're ever looking for another novel to do, I would certainly do Life During Wartime with you, man.
Hell yeah. I do want to really sort of, Pete, I am terrible at like, I'll pick up a collection and never finish it. I'll get like two or three stories in and be like, oh, okay, whatever, man. And it's not even like whatever, man, as in like, what do you call it? Like it's bad or anything. It's just generally like after a while, I just sort of like, okay, I'll pick it up someday. Like I'll put it down and be like, yeah, I'll get back to that.
Exactly.
Months later. Oh shit. I have so many of these books with that are only 20% finished. God damn it. Then you feel guilty about it and never do it. Anyway, thank you for joining me on a tour of my brain for a moment, Pete.
I was wondering if you were saying that to me or the audience.
¿Por qué no los dos?
I'd like to give a special thank you for Chewy for his constant input into this episode.
It's excellent job, Chewy. you get the two bones.
Yes. Oh, we are going to wrestle after this episode. I'm going to jump on his dumb ass.
All right. Wear him out so he gets sleepy. I see.
Oh, please.
Good
job.
All right. Well, Pete, thanks for joining me. I did not know that you were a big shepherd head. So this was sort of like, I was wondering if it was simply that I was going to need to sort of like give you a link to the copy of the collection. Is you probably have it on your shelf or some shit.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I had it somewhere. So
figured. All right. Well, in any case, thanks for reading this one with me, Pete.
My pleasure. It was fun.
Did you have any last, I don't know, anything that you needed to get out of the system other than thanking Chewy for his input?
No, not really. Just, you know, it's nice being back in the swing of thing with you guys again. I like reading books and talking about them, and I rarely get that opportunity unless we're talking about workbooks with names like Empowering Yourself, you know?
Yeah. The Art of Not Giving a Fuck or whatever the fuck.
Oh, God, yes.
All those bullshit, you know. Atomic Habits is like...
Yeah.
Atomic Habits. I'm gonna go nuclear on you. Fuck you.
Building your castle, you know, it's like, shut up.
Who cut the cheese? Anyway. Well,
and
in any
on
case,
that note, yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, Pete. I know how that feels, but hey. Power to you, man. Anyway, everyone out there, go read the story. Actually, I picked this up just to plug briefly. This is the first volume of Lucius Shepard's collection. And I picked it up over at Subterranean Press. The ebook is very, very cheap. The physical one is not very, very cheap.
Mm-hmm.
My recommendation, ebook, if you're just looking to read. So in any case, go check it out. Please do, because this is actually, I really, really enjoyed this story. I think you will too. In any case, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time here on Podside.